I can't. Good. My parents are fine. They went on a cruise. I think this. I guess so. I don't know. This is their 56th anniversary this week.
Wow.
So instead of us having to take them out, they went and took themselves out. My mother always tells me that she's spending our money now. So I told her the least she could do is send a thank you card or something. But she's never done that. Anyway, hopefully she'll be back in 2 weeks. So this is the third year we're trying to learn topics in halacha. I say trying. I'm not convinced anybody's learning anything. Sometimes people ask me what I do, so I say I talk to myself. I do this professionally. So as far as what topics we're going to do, and Matan is so optimistic, somebody in the office sent me some kind of official-looking piece of paper asking me to fill out all the topics that we're going to do this year, so I still haven't filled it out yet. I guess today I can fill out the first paragraph in it. I mean, very frankly, I have a whole bunch of things that I'm thinking of, but part of it will depend upon also if there are any topics that you would like me to cover, and if I find them sufficiently interesting, then I will try to fulfill any and all requests. There are lots of things we've done over the last 2 years, so there could be certain situations you'll ask me to do something, and I'll just direct you to some website and tell you where you can already find where we spoke about that. Anyway, today's topic is, it won't be clear exactly, so I have to tell you what it is that we're looking for. And then I'll give you a little bit of an introduction again. Somebody came and asked me a question during Sukkot. And the question was a very simple question as follows. He wanted to sleep in the sukkah. And he wanted his son to sleep in the sukkah with him. And apparently there wasn't enough room to bring all kinds of beds there. So he carried out a mattress for his son, and he put it on the table. And he put his son to sleep on the table on the mattress. And his wife walked outside and saw the mattress on the table. And what did she say?
What?
Yeah, why? Yeah, I mean, what is this? Akedat Yitzchak? What are you going to do to the... What are you going to do? How can you put my kid on a table? Because everybody knows that you're not allowed to sit on a table or sleep on a table or do all kinds of unbecoming things on a table. So he asked me if this was okay or not. So far be it from me to get involved in an argument between a husband and a wife. But what exactly is the halacha? That's what we're looking for. Now, here is our brief introduction. Although I had a really long and good introduction 2 years ago, you should definitely listen to that. That was very good. But today I'll give a very brief introduction. When somebody asks a question of Jewish law, the first thing has to go off in your head when you're trying to deal with it is, what is the status of the question at hand? Are we dealing with something which fundamentally is a Torah law? Like if somebody asks a question, there's really no food here, can I eat pork? So, right, are we dealing with a Torah law? Or somebody can call up and say, listen, there's no food over here, and the bread is not Pat Yisrael, it's Pat Akum. Okay, those are not the same questions. Do you all appreciate that? Or somebody can say that there's no Chol of Yisrael, there is Chol of Yisrael. And by the way, that is a topic that I will come back to. I did not get to Chol of Yisrael last year. Or for that matter, Haagen-Dazs ice cream, which is a very important question. So, if somebody poses a question, the first thing you have to try to figure out, is this a Torah law? Is this a rabbinic law? Is this a custom? Is this a superstition? I mean, people never want to hear this, but when, lo aleinu, if somebody loses a relative, they're sitting Shiva, and they call me up, or I go over and ask if you have any questions, and they don't want to hear this, but when it comes to the laws of Avelut, other than putting the person in the ground, and I'm sorry for putting it in such terms, other than burying somebody, you have very, very few, if any, absolute laws which are Torah laws. When it comes to the laws of Avilut, you're dealing with a combination of rabbinic law, custom, guilt, and superstition, which is a wonderful combination. And then when it comes down to it, more likely than not, almost anything they're going to ask is going to be allowed, but it won't make a difference because they're not going to want to do it anyway. So when it came to a question like this, are you allowed to sit on a table? This is one of these laws that we are going to qualify and say, this is a halacha of the gananot, right? What's the halacha of the gananot? It's every gananet has taught the kids that you can't sit on a table. It's that you learn this in the kindergarten, if not before, correct? So now, again, I would not be the one who wants to pick on all the gananot all over the world, but I still then have to ask myself, okay, is there in fact a prohibition over here? Is it a custom? Is it a minhag? Now you can come back and say, why are you making this so complicated, other than that you're going to have to teach maybe 20 topics this year and you obviously ran out of material already. You can say, why are you making this so complicated? It is certainly a Jewish custom. Now, again, that makes a big difference. Is it a custom or is it a halacha? Right? That's something which is very significant. Second, if it is a custom, customs need to be based upon something. Which means just because you have a minhag, and by the way, there are all kinds of examples like this. From the shul that everybody, when they'd walk in the shul, they would bow down when they would walk in. And finally somebody asked, why do they back down? So it turned out that before they did the renovations, the ceiling was very low. And when you had to walk in, everybody bowed down before they walked in. So now they continue back, because that's the minhag, is that you bow. So if you come into such a law or such a custom, you bow down before you walk in. Or the story of the woman who, before she would cook the meat, would cut off both sides on the sides of the meat. So why should she cut it off? She says, my mother did it that way. I asked the mother, yeah, my pot was small, so it was cut off from both sides of the meat. I mean, it has nothing to do with halacha. Just because people, and again, I can go on and on and on with customs, which you can tell me, oh no, these are customs, but not everything that Jews do necessarily have the status of a minhag. Was that clear enough? Not everything that Jews do have a status of a minhag. On the other hand, excuse me? Yes, over here, the Rishonim already were very clever. Some say minhag Yisrael Torah hu. If something's a minhag, it's already like Torah law. And others pointed out and said, if you notice, the letters of minhag also spell out the word Gehenim. And following a silly minhag can lead you in the opposite direction from where you may want to end up. Me. No, but that then becomes the question, and that becomes an excellent question. Which means before then we could try to figure out on any given thing, we at least have to do some primary research and see, okay, so where does this come from? Or do we have an idea where it came from? And over here in this particular example, none of us know yet, are we dealing with something which is a Torah law? Are we dealing with something which is a rabbinic law? Are we dealing with something which is custom? Or something which is less than that? You can guess if you want. My initial feeling, as soon as he asked me the question, what I said to him, you know what? There's a book which is called Shmirat HaGuf HaNefesh, unless it's Shmirat HaNefesh, but no, it's HaGuf HaNefesh, written by Rav Yosef Yitzchak Lerner. And I said, I'm willing to bet he has something on this. Because anything has to do with guarding the soul and superstitions and so on, he has it. And I was going to bring, I actually have a copy of it at home, inscribed by the author to me, 2 volumes, and I have his next book, and all kinds of interesting things there. And I ended up not looking in the book, but I'm getting way ahead of myself in this particular story. So let's go back. Let's go on. Yeah. Yeah. That's not for today, but okay. But that's okay. But we could talk about that. So let's begin. We'll begin with source number 2. And by the way, we're going to have, this will be a major test if you're appropriate to be in this class. There, you have four pages in front of you. Some of you, like my copy, actually is numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4 in the pages. Some of you, it's 1, 4, 2, and 3, or other things. If you can't handle this, then this may not be the right class for you. I'm just warning you here. Okay. Excuse me? No. I'm here. I'm just saying it's not everybody's ready for that. Okay. Let's start with source number 2, a pasuk in Yechezkel. The pasuk says, "Hamizbeach etz shalosh amot gavoa, ve'arko shtayim amot umiksotav lo ve'arko v'kirotav etz, ve'deber elai zeh ha'shulchan asher lefnei Hashem." Yechezkel has a vision. Yechezkel lived when? After the Chorban Bayit Rishon. Yechezkel has a vision of the future Beit HaMikdash, whether it's the second or the third. You can look in commentaries, or maybe you can even claim he has a vision of the first. But apparently he has visions of a future Beit HaMikdash. Over here, he describes the Mizbeach, HaMizbeach 8, and then he describes the various sizes. And at the very end, the Pasuk says, V'deber elai ze shulchan asher lefnei Hashem. This is the shulchan in front of God. So the Gemara is going to note that the Pasuk is describing the Mizbeach. Why at the end of the verse does it say, and that's the Shulchan? So what would your conclusion be? Your conclusion would be is that either it's talking about two different things, or that sometimes the word Mizbeach can have a connotation of Shulchan. Source number 1 is the Gemara. This is one of a handful of Gemarot that have the same teaching. This is the very end of Masechet Chagiga. It quotes the pasuk at first, HaMizbeach Eitz, and so on and so forth. At the end of the second line, Rabbi Yochanan v'Resh Lakish, they both said together, they were friends, brother-in-laws, chavrutot. Rabbi Yochanan v'Resh Lakish, the Amri Terivayhu, both of them said, Bizman shebeit hamikdash kayam, Mizbeach mechaper al adam. When the time when the temple stood, it was the Mizbeach that brought atonement for the individual. Achshav shulchano shel adam mechaper alav. And now, in the absence of the Beit HaMikdash, it is a person's table that brings about atonement. Now, let's note, what does the Gemara say, and what doesn't the Gemara say? So, which will be easier for us to decide? What does the Gemara say? It makes an analogy and an identification. It says that just like the Mizbeach, during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, brought atonement, a person's table brings atonement. What doesn't the Gemara say? We don't know why it's equal. It's because of the verse, not the Gemara says. But what doesn't the Gemara say? How? Meaning, if I were to ask you how the Mizbeach works, what would you say? You take a korban, you put it on the Mizbeach, and you light it up. Listen, this may justify the way that some people cook, right? You burn the thing on the Mizbeach, and this brings about kapara. But how exactly do you create the kapara, or what creates the kapara? What's the kaparaizing agent in terms of a person's table? How does that work? And here, I can assure you that we have no agreement whatsoever, and we will now see a whole bunch of different opinions on what exactly this Gemara means. We'll start with the Me'iri in source number 3. Zeh shepatach bepasuk zeh bemizbeach v'siyem b'shulchan, כדי להאיר ולא מלאכה בזמן שבית המקדש קיים מזבח בכפר, עכשיו שאין בית המקדש קיים שולחנו של אדם שבי מכפר. But how does it work? So now you see where it's underlined at the end. He says, שולחנו של אדם בהכנסת אורחים מכפרת עליו. So over here, the Me'iri, and I could have saved this for next week, we'll talk about Avram Avinu, and talk about Avram Avinu in terms of being a Baal Chesed, or 2 weeks even, when the angels come in. And here we see that when a person who does hachnasat archim, it's the hachnasat archim which is the thing that brings about atonement. Why? Other than the fact that Me'iri said it. Why? Or that's a bad question. You can't ask such questions. He says that during the time of the temple, the altar brought about atonement. Without a temple, a person's table brings atonement. How so? By inviting guests. to the home. Guests who are eating on your table, that brings about atonement. Why? Okay, the Meiri doesn't tell us, so we'll leave. Yes, we have a guess.
No, not a guess, a question. Does that mean if you don't have a guest, the table stops being
Yeah, so that's correct. That's very strange. It seems to be that the only way that the table actually works as an atonement agent is if you have guests. So that would seem to be the implication of the Meiri. The Sefer HaManhig, which is also a Rishon, around the same time, 13th century or so, 12th, 13th century, writes as follows. Ubavru eshesh kula knesset archim kechola korbanot. He said, and now you know where he's going already. He said, "Hachnasat orchin, bringing guests into your home, is like bringing all the korbanot." Shenemar, and he brings the verse from Yecheskel. He brings the conclusion from the Gemara. Patach b'mizbech, siyem b'shulchan. I skip to the third line. Lomer lecha bizman shebeit hamikdash kayam mizbech mechaper, uvizman shein beit hamikdash kayam shulchano shaldam mechaper alav lahachil bo ha'aniyim. In order to feed the poor. By the way, that's a little different. Correct. Hachnasat archim, and feeding aniim are not necessarily the same mitzvah. If you take poor people into your home, then there's a mitzvah of hachnasat archim and of giving aniim. But what if you just give money to aniim, you give food for the poor, but you didn't take them to your table? Did this somehow not work as well? So what we have over here is a slight, difference in terms of the direction over here. We can clearly call this two different opinions. The opinion of the Meiri is, how does your table bring about atonement? By bringing guests into your home. According to the Manhig, how does it bring about atonement? By feeding the poor. And again, I can now ask the same question. Yeah, so exactly how does this work? Are there any type of dynamics involved in this? What is the secret? Source number 5 is the Marsha. One of the various Gemaras that speak about this, so we quoted Gemara in Chagiga, there's also Gemara in Brachot, and he's going to be now quoting from the Gemara in Brachot over here, even though he's commenting on a third place where the Gemara says it, the Gemara in Menachot. It says, HaMizbeach 8, V'deber Elai, and so on, Pirish HaTosfot, D'gdolo L'gima, the great is the taste, which is not clear what it means, V'chein Mashma Perek HaRoa D'ka Amar. And also in Brachot, which is the chapter, is called Perek HaRo'eh, D'ka'amar, where it says, V'ha-ma'arich al shulchano. What does ma'arich al shulchano mean? A person who spends long time by the table. Right? One of these meals that really drag out. So is this a good thing or a bad thing? What? Yeah, go on. Okay. Okay. V'chein mashar perek haroah d'kama v'amarech l'shulchana, which is a good thing. Why? The Gemara continues to say, Dilma ati aniye v'yahivle. Because maybe if the meal was between 12 and 12:15, so then it's a very short window of opportunity. But if the meal goes on from 12 to 2, 12 to 3, then there's a greater opportunity for a poor person to knock on the door, and then you can invite them in and you can give them food as well. So it seems from the Gemara that the meal, which is dragging out, is a good thing. Why? Because now there's a better opportunity of feeding a poor person. Not sure which one it is. Ayin shamo aval matnitan beperek gimel de avot mashma mishum de amrinan alav divrei Torah va'ayin bezeh beperishi avot. So now he brings in another opinion. He says, it's as far as the table bringing about kapara, the primary interpretation of the Maharsha is, again, to feed the poor person, like we saw in the Sefer HaManhig. But then he goes in another direction, bringing primary evidence. What's that? A Mishnah. The Mishnah is in Pirkei Avot, which we'll see soon again. And there he says the implication is, how does a table bring about atonement? He says, by virtue of the Divrei Torah, which are being said on that table. So now we have, what are we up to? How many interpretations? So now we have... Hachnasat Rechim, feeding Aniim, and now we have also to say Divrei Torah. Now we're up to three different interpretations for how our table brings about atonement. We'll get a fourth interpretation in source number 6, which is Torah Chaim on Masechet Shavuot. He quotes the Gemara in Chagiga, which we started with. And he said that the table brings about kapara. And we are on the top of page 2. Can you find it?
Six.
Okay, we're on the top of page 2 now. Yes? We've been successful? We found it? Yes. But we're starting from the top of page 2. Bizman shebeit hamikdash kayam mizbeach mechaper al adam, second line. Achshav she'ein mizbeach kayam shulchano shel adam mechaper alav, v'nireh, and he says that it seems, to be shulchano shel tzadik ayri. We're talking about the table of a righteous person. Not any table. It applies. That we're talking about the table of a righteous person. She'einu ochel el lesova nafsho. The kiyum nishmato. That the righteous person, bless you, is not a hedonist. The righteous person is eating for spiritual needs, and therefore somehow this righteous person, their food is being transformed into a spiritual experience. Shenenet mi reach ma'achav havidumia de korban ha'ola l'reach nichoach, and somehow the soul process which is taking place is somehow similar to a korban, which is l'reach nichoach, a pleasant smell to God. Diafagav de l'shach ze klape mala dibratora koloshim b'nei adam derech mashal. So he allows that this is somewhat fanciful, but he says that still this is the interpretation that he likes. Can I explain this, or did this make any sense to you? The person who sits down to eat, and the table is full of wonderful delicacies, but they sit down and they say, my whole eating, I'm not going to eat everything there. I'm not going to eat things just because they're there. I'm eating, again, it goes to a basic question, do you live to eat or do you eat to live? So over here, he is talking about somebody who, what? Who eats to live. They eat in order to be an Oved Hashem. They eat in order to be able to serve God. Consequently, they are sacrificing their appetite, as it were. They're sacrificing themselves and not giving in to physical needs. And they're just doing what they need to do to be a spiritual entity. So apparently he sees some kind of analogy between this and between bringing a korban. Because when you bring a korban, you're also essentially sacrificing the physical in order to somehow try to get a spiritual relationship or dynamic. Now, if that didn't sound like it made all that much sense, then I apologize. I'm just trying to understand what it is that he's in fact saying over here. But those of us who are keeping count, we just now found a fourth interpretation. And incidentally, when you find one Talmudic teaching, and you find already, and there are more, we're not finished, and then you find a whole bunch of interpretations to what this means, this is not necessarily confidence building. Now, I could say that all of these are correct, and the basic teaching is that a table is like a mizbeach, and all of these things are right, but it's so far, it's really not that simple. We're good? Okay. We have a long source over here, the Sefer Abudraham. The Abudraham is from Ashkenaz. He's also a Rishon, time of Tosfot, more or less. And he starts off with a different issue completely. He's not starting off with our teaching, namely, how is a table like a mizbeach? He starts off with a different law. V'nagu ha'olam, so here we have a minhag. Kishemavrachim birkat ha'mazon, shemisalkin ha'sakin me'al ha'shulchan, they take the knife off of the table. Have any of you ever heard of this custom? Do you do this? Seven. There's a difference of opinion whether you do this on Shabbos also. Yes, are you aware of that? That even people that keep this law, there's a difference of opinion whether you do it on Shabbat or not do it on Shabbat. Why not? Well, let's see what he says the reason for it is. Excuse me? It's a law. It's a minhag. It's a minhag.
So you take the knife off the table?
Yes. Take the knife off the table.
Have it there.
Right. Let's say you have a knife to cut bread. Right? So there is a custom to take the knife off the table before Birkat HaMazon. So he says, V'nagu olam, that's what people do. People take the knife off. So if you're asking me a law minhag, how does he describe it? V'nahagu, this is a minhag. V'hatam mida amrinin v'perak haroa, what's the reason? And he quotes the Gemara in Brachot, quoting the verse in Yecheskel, Hamizbeach et shalosh amot, and so on and so forth. Skip to the next line. Patach b'mizbeach, end of the line. V'siyem b'shulchan, beginning of the fourth line. Omer of Yochan of Itamer of Elazar b'zman she'beit hamikdash kayam, mizbeach mechaper al adam. V'achshav she'ein beit hamikdash kayam, shulchano mechaper alav. And now that there is no beit hamikdash, the shulchan brings about kapara. V'hainu d'amrinin hatam, and that, and it further says over there in that Gemara in Brachot, a person who spends more and more time by the table, they'll have a longer and longer life, unless they're eating, right? And what's the reason? Because a poor person may come and eat on the table. By the way, the Abu Raham does not necessarily, as of this point, say that the idea of the ani is the explanation of the idea of kapara. It sounds like he's saying, yeah, there are two gemarot there, and one after the other, but the second one doesn't necessarily interpret the first one. And then he continues, ve'ein staka gdola mizot, and there's no great staka of this, as it says, utstaka tatzil mimavet, that charity saves from death. V'nei ha'shulchan b'bayit kimizbeach b'beit hamikdash, and the table at home is like the altar in the temple. Ma mizbeach mechaper, just like the altar brings about atonement, af shulchan mechaper, likewise the table brings about atonement. V'habarzel mikatzer yamav shel adam, and barzel, iron, shortens people's lives. Now, does anything now come in your head about iron, about barzel, and about the mizbeach? What? Is it Mizbeach or is it the end of Yitro?
No.
Right after the Seret
HaDibrot? Yes, you're right.
It's a little bit before Mishpatim. Yeah, right. So the... You shouldn't use Barzel when you iron, when you make the Mizbeach. Why? Because over there we also have this teaching that iron... Well, the Torah does, I don't believe, says is iron shortens people's lives. Why? Because they would make weapons out of iron, and the stone is supposed to make a person's life longer. So now you already know, based upon this analogy, what he's going to say next. So now why do you have to take the knife off the table? Because it's made out of barzel. And incidentally, if this is the case, and if I really want to take the analogy, then what should I say? I should say you should never be allowed to bring a knife on a table at all. And for that matter, you shouldn't be able to use silverware either. Okay, so I'm not going to say that. And don't quote... Right, and you shouldn't be able to make a motzi either with a knife. Again, if you really want to take his analogy to its logical conclusion, or maybe illogical conclusion, that's perhaps what you should say. But let's see how... Could be. But now let's see how he finesses this. So therefore, how did he finesse it? At the time that you're making the bracha, which bracha? Well, you're not talking the bracha in the beginning, so in the bracha at the end. At the time that you say Birkat HaMazon, and you're thanking God, and so on, which means you're bringing spiritual power, which is making your life longer, that's not the right moment to have iron on the table, which shortens life. Let's continue. Yesh anashim she'enam rotzim lasir hamapa me'al shulchan kodem Birkat HaMazon. Some people don't like to take off the tablecloth. And this, I am leaving now, and I believe Neder will come back. I will believe Neder come back to the tablecloth issue. V'gam makpidim shelo yishar shulchan belo pat b'shat Birkat HaMazon. And they're also very careful to make sure that there is at least some bread on the table. K'dei shetachul habracha bo, that the blessings that you're going to say will somehow impact the leftover bread, v'yitpashet mimenu shefa haribori, and that will then bring about this shefa haribori. It will bring about this good. It's plenty. It's you're saying a bracha to God, and this and therefore having the bread there becomes symbolic of the bracha will be on the bread, and will bring about more and more food in the future. And he quotes Gemaras that say, if you don't bring bread, then you bring about bad things. And it further says in Avot, and here is the source that we so alluded to earlier, Kol Shulchan She'ochlo Alav, any table that was eaten upon, v'amru alav divrei Torah, and somebody said a dvar Torah on that table, ki'ilu ochlu mishulchano shel makom, as if you ate from God's table, as it were. Shenemar v'diber elai zeh shulchan. Which verse did he quote? Which verse does he quote? The same verse that we started with in Yechezkel. So therefore, the implication is that if you say divrei Torah by your table, you will now make that table like a mizbeach, a holy place. The kol shulchan she'achlu alav v'lo amru alav divrei Torah, and any table that you would eat by and not say divrei Torah, ki'ilu achlu mizivchei metim, as if you've eaten from, and this is really a term which references idolatry, is as if you've eaten from things slaughtered to idols. Shenemar, kikol shulchanot, malei kia, and so on, which is not a very nice thing. Ulefisha ayidei achila v'shteya yetzer hara mitgaber v'hatavot mitgaberet. And now he introduces another point. Now, before I get to this other point, this idea of saying a dvar Torah by the table, again, we've already seen it now, a couple of people having said it, and this is a Rishon, saying that, again, it's not just a question of a kapara, but he sees this as being part of creating the food and turning the food into a spiritual experience. By the way, one of my sons, if I would say to him, can you say a Dvar Torah, then he would always say the same thing. He would quote a Mishnah in Brachot, Shlosha she'achlu ke'achat. Do you know this Mishnah? Three people eat together, chayav lezamein. Three people eat together, chayav lezamein. So that's a Dvar Torah. And then he would continue and say, again, shelo she'achlu ke'achat, three people that eat together as one have to have zamein. V'achad she'achal ke'shlosha chayav b'dieta. And one who eats as three is, and that would be his Dvar Torah. I think he has stopped. I think when he hit around 15 or so, he stopped. But we had this going on for a number of years. But there's a tension over here. And this tension probably can be discussed better by a sociologist or an anthropologist. Any of you anthropologists? Okay, good. So I can say whatever I want. Eating is something which makes us feel as part of the animal kingdom. Correct? I mean, we eat, animals eat, and as my son would probably say, some of us eat like animals. When it comes to eating, and to many of our animalistic needs, what society does is it tries to create all kinds of things, very often artificial, so that we don't feel that we are eating like animals. And that, I think, is where all kinds of things like etiquette and so on come from, is in order to take the human eating ritual and make it different from the animalistic eating ritual. Judaism... Excuse me? As I said, they create all kinds of etiquette. I mean, does it really make a difference if the fork is on the right side or the left side? Don't answer. I mean, does this really make a difference, or does it make a difference? Excuse me. But the side I'm saying, where you put the fork, I understand, but where you put the fork doesn't really make so much of a difference, does it? But again, we create all kinds of etiquette, and part of it is in order to make our eating experience different from the eating experience of the animal world. So I can say that when it comes to Judaism, the most basic thing would be all the laws of kashrut, for example, and therefore we have to pause before we eat and make a bracha, and I can again get into all kinds of details. What the direction that he seems to be going over here is that eating itself is something which is perhaps instinctual. And being instinctual, again, makes it into this animalistic type of behavior. So how do I deal with something which is animalistic and instinctual? So I need to somehow to transform it and turn it into something which is spiritual. So that seems to really be what he's getting at in terms of this idea of saying the Dvar Torah. Let's just read this again. As it says in Avo, Kol Shulchan, and then it says in the next line, Ulefish ayidei achila v'shteya yetzer hara mitgaber v'ata'ava mitgaberet. What does that mean? That by eating, the Yetzer Hara gets stronger and one's desires get stronger. Why? Because man with intelligence and spirituality has just now made a concession towards their physical part. So now, at the same time in making this concession to the physicality of myself and the instinctual parts, I need to elevate the spiritual side at the very same time in order to create some kind of a counterbalance. Did that make sense?
Shenemar v'achal v'savah v'dashan v'pana elokim. V'slicha, v'pana el Elohim acherim, that you're going to eat and be satiated and so on, and then you'll turn to other gods. V'chal t'v'savah t'hishamru l'chem pen yiftel levavchem, that when you eat and are satisfied, be very careful not to turn your hearts. Which means that we have a number of times in the Torah that the verses say, you're going to eat, be satisfied, and now you're going to turn away. So he's pointing out that the Yetzer, that once one fulfills physical desires, there is this fear of spirituality being crushed, and therefore we need to do something to elevate the spirituality as well. Next line where it's underlined, L'chein his hiruni razal, and therefore the Chachamim warned us, L'daber b'divrei Torah b'shat achila k'dei shelo techta. And therefore it warns us in order to eat, in order to say divrei Torah when we're eating, to protect us from the Yetzer Hara. Now, in this, again, relatively long Abu Draham, what did he do? Where did he start? He started with the knife, and his source of the problem of the knife was the whole idea of the Mizbeach. From then, he very seamlessly went and continued with all kinds of other things about eating, never really getting away from this idea of the Mizbeach, but on the other, again, going from the knife to the Ani, right? Again, he got almost every, he missed Achnasat Rachim, to the Divrei Torah, the Yetzer Hara. He touches all the bases over here, but it sounds like his basic understanding is the Shulchan, the table, is like a Mizbeach, and it doesn't have to just be, in one sense, it's like a Mizbeach in all kinds of ways, and therefore our eating should be conducted in a certain way in order to keep this analogy with the Mizbeach. Yeah.
Right. 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 And what I told you then was the Rashi in the Gemara Beitza. Mm-hmm. Rashi in Gemara Beitza on the pasuk Shavat Vayinafash, he says that the person gets a neshama yitera on Shabbat. Rashi explains, why do you need a neshama yitera, right? An extra soul on Shabbat. He says, because on Shabbat, you're going to eat and drink more. So if you eat and drink more, now you need an extra neshama and be able to handle, to spiritually handle the additional food. That's why you need a neshama yitera. All those three-day yantivs that people had, and they must have incredible amount of soul. That's all I can say. Right? Right. The panim yafa. Right. the panim yafot in source. Yes, but let's even see it sharper now. The panim yafot on Shemot Perek Lamed, he goes one step further, and he says, and he's going to tell us, of course, that the Mizbeach is like the Shulchan, and before you go into the Beit HaMikdash, what do you need to do? You need to go to the mikvah, one needs to wash hands and feet, and so on. So he says, oh, that's the reason why you need to wash your hands before you eat. Now, let's slow down and see exactly what he says it. Umized lamdu chazal, where it's underlined, rechitzat yadayim letfila ulasuda, ki yatfila la'amod lefnei Hashem, Hashem yitbarach, kama shekutuv chazal, and so on, shiiret atzmo ki ilo made beheichal Hashem. So he's saying is that when a person prays, again, I don't know if you know this law, but there is a law that when you walk in, not even to shul, before you daven Shemon Esrei or Shachar, whatever, before you're going to daven, that you should wash your hands as if you're washing for bread. You should wash your hands two or three times on each hand. The normative approach is to wash one's hands, but not to make a bracha. The Vilna Gaon claimed you even make a bracha. It's even a mitzvah to make a bracha on that washing. So now he's making reference to this, and he's saying, why? Because when you daven, when you pray, you should visualize and yourself as if you're walking into the holy, into the Heichal. So when a person would walk into the Heichal, walk into the temple, they would need to wash themselves beforehand. So before you pray, you need to wash. And then he continues and he says, that means that the same approach that you should have if you were walking towards the Mizbeach should be the approach that you're having when you're walking towards your table. Now, from a source like this, I can now go even further. But those of you who are counting, now how many different interpretations are we up to now? Are we up to five? What? We're at least up to five different interpretations. Okay, source number nine, the care. Okay. Yeah, but correct. He's not talking about the atonement so much, but he's saying because the analogy should treat it the same way. Correct. Source number nine, the Karen Ohr says, "V'zeh shenemar lav divrei Torah haynu shachilato lishmahi, o bekavanah pshuta kamur lechazei kachol avodat Hashem, umi shachonin bedat yesh kavanah letov dugmata korban mamash kiyadu lemaskil bichlekazu hi leratzon." So he's saying is that when a person, he's just explaining this Divrei Torah a little bit more. Again, the starting point is the Gemara that says the table is like the Shulchan, and therefore you need to say Divrei Torah. But he said it's not enough to say Dvar Torah. He says that Dvar Torah somehow now has to take the whole food experience and turn it into a korban as it would. So therefore he's really taking this into, by the way, the key word, v'chilekazuhi l'ratzon. Do you guys know what the word l'ratzon means? It's a very interesting word, which we use every day. Towards the end of Shemona Esrei, we would say Ritzei. What does Ritzei mean? Okay, at the very end of the Seder, we get up to Nirtza. Okay, so what is Ritzei? What is Nirtza? What is L'Ratzon? What does it mean that let the acts that I've done be acceptable or pleasing to God? Which means at the end of praying, we say, okay, I pray that my prayers will be accepted. Right after we get to Shemaya Tefillah, Ritzei Hashem, Ram Chesar, meaning accept what's going on. At the end of the Seder, Nirtza, let everything that we've done now be acceptable to God. So over here, what he's saying is let the food be liratzon, be something which is appeasing to God, which means by a korban, that makes a great deal of sense. Meaning, we say it by prayer because prayer is in the place of the korban. But over here, he's saying it, well, if the table is analogous to the mizbeach, so therefore, why do we need the divrei Torah? We need the divrei Torah in order to create the kavanah, that eating now needs kavanah. Again, I hope I'm not ruining all food for you at this point. let's look at one more source, and then we'll get to the Shulchan Aruch and try to figure out what happened over here. The Shla Shnei Luchot Abrit, source 10. He is obviously aware of almost all the sources that I brought. The ones that lived after him, he's not aware of. But almost all the things that we've seen, he has seen. And he quotes a couple of people who put them together in a very, very pretty way. He quotes the Baal Tola'at Yaakov, Chishiv Shlosha Dvrim Shadam Tzrichim L'Kayem Al Shulchanau. There's a number of things that you need to do on your table. What? Achilat Aniyim V'tara U'Birkat HaMazon. Dumya D'Shulchan Gavoa Shu Mizbeach. Shehu Muchtar B'Shlosha K'tarim. He says, why are there these three things? And he's focusing on three. What? Feed the poor, say Divrei Torah, and say Birkat HaMazon. And this is analogous to three things that are included in the work, in the service of God by the Beit HaMikdash. Kohanim oskim ba'avodah. The Kohanim, they bring about the Korban. What do the Levi'im do? V'Levi'im shorim al duchan. They're on the duchan and they will be singing. V'Yisrael b'ma'adam hayu korim b'ma'aseh bereshit. And the Yisrael, what would the average Yisrael be doing as the Kohen brings the Korban and Levi'im do the songs? It says that they would be reading from the beginning of Bereshit. They'd be reading the Torah. They'd be learning Torah. Achilat aniyim al shulchano dugmat avodah shehi hakorban. When you give your food to others, he's saying that is like the korban. That is the avodah of the kohen. That is like the... And again, I guess there really is some kind of sacrifice going on over here. This food is yours, but you're giving it to another. He is saying that that's analogous to the korban. V'divrei Torah al shulchan. That's like the Yisraelim who were reading from the Torah. Ubirkat Hamazon kineged hashir sheLeviim hayu omrim baduchan, and that was like the songs that Leviim were singing. So therefore, he went and he combined at least three of the interpretations that we've seen and said, yeah, if the table is like the altar brought about kapara. But he says the altar had, you know, it wasn't just the Kohanim, it was all these things going on at once, and therefore we want to create all this. Now again, this is very creative, it's very nice the way that he took, I'm not saying everything that we've seen beforehand, he took a lot of them. Now, everything that we've seen till this point, as far as I know, did not make its way into the Shulchan Aruch in terms of law. Okay, now you'll say to me, hold it, isn't there a thing you should say a Dvar Torah by a meal? Yeah. But as far as I know, there's no reference to Dvar Torah because that's going to be like the Mizbeach. Which means, is it good to have Aniyim? Sure, it's good to have Aniyim. Why? Because we have to take care of Aniyim, but not because of the Mizbeach. This whole analogy with the Mizbeach, as far as I know, made it into the Shulchan Aruch in one place, which was none of the reasons we've brought up till now. And let's take a look. Source 11. Lo Yivtsa Ad sheyaviu lefanav melach. When a person is going to make a motzi, they should not make a motzi until there is salt on the table. O liftan, or something else to dip the bread into. Lelefet bo prusa habitzia. Ve'im hinikiyah shimitubela. Then it goes into some other considerations. Next line, words bolded. The Rama writes, Haga umikom makom. Whether you're going to use the salt or not use the salt, by the way, this is very interesting. Sometimes people will ask me, you know, I'm in a low salt diet, low sodium diet, do I have to dip? No. What does the Rama say? You don't have to dip the bread in. Certainly if it was baked with salt, he says it just needs to be on the table. The halacha is the salt needs to be on the table, not the salt needs to be used. Okay? See that? Well, I'll read it again. Where it's bold. Okay, so here you see black and white, the Rama bringing our teaching. Actually, he says one more word than we had in the Gemara. What does he say? And the eating is like the Korban. So if the eating is like the Korbanot had salt on them, so you also need to have salt on the Mizbeach on the table over here. V'nemar, kol korbanecha tagriv melach. And so on. V'hu magin min ha-paraniyot. And now he tells us the reason why you need salt on the table. It protects you against negative forces, which goes back to our, perhaps superstition. His source for this is number 12, the Shibalei Halekit, when we're on page number 4 already. U'mashinagu levtzo al ha-melach, perish ha-ga'onim. So even though he quoted the Shibalei Halekit, the Shibalei Halekit quotes early sources, l'misha matzina shal shulchan nikra mizbeach, kedichtiv mizbeach, eitz, and so on and so forth, quotes the same verses over here, and says, since it's like the Mizbeach, therefore it needs to have salt. Which means basically all those other interpretations that we saw did not make it into the Shulchan Aruch. The one that made it into the Shulchan Aruch is this one, is that the table is like the altar, so therefore you need to have salt on your table. And what does this do for us in terms of sitting on the table, not sitting on the table, sleeping on the table? We haven't seen anything about it, so therefore, let's go one more step. The Magen Avraham in Source 13 writes, Domel Mizbeach, ulachain asul harog kina al shulchan. And if the table's like a mizbeach, don't go killing bugs on your table. Number 14 is very intriguing, and I'm only reading this now because I'm not going to talk about it, but maybe I will talk about it again. He writes, and it protects you. Katzav Beit Yosef b'shem atos b'shem midrash ki shi'israel yeshu mamtinim ze et ze ad shi'lu yideihem. That when Jews are sitting around the table and they're waiting for one another to wash, right? What happens when you're sitting and you're waiting? Right? This has ever happened to you? You wash, other people haven't washed yet. So what are you supposed to do? The heim lo b'mitzvot. At that moment, no one's performing a mitzvah. Now, I think that that's quite bizarre, because you are doing a mitzvah. What mitzvah are you doing? You just wash for a motzi. You're having derech eretz for someone else. You're waiting for somebody else. So I'm saying, I think this is quite strange. But he says, nonetheless, if you have salt on the table, brit melech magin aleim, the salt will protect them. Because the salt, it's called a brit. It's called a covenant. So it will protect them. Ayim ha-shakav simkov samachvav, detov ludaber b'divrei Torah, b'lishev batel. And therefore he says, it's better to speak divrei Torah as you're waiting for the other people to wash. Now all of you are going to look at me and say, well, what are you talking about? You're not allowed to talk. Not just temanim. He says, and that's why I said, I'm going to leave this right now, b'li neder, I'll come back to it. So it says, you know, it's, that the salt will protect you, but it's really not good to sit around doing nothing, so you should say divrei Torah. It's better to say divrei Torah, l'shev batel, v'tov mishneim, shel lafzik klal. And the best thing is not to wait at all. So
you shouldn't wait for the other
people. Shouldn't wait for anybody. Shouldn't wait for anybody. So anyway, as I said, so anyway, I just said, b'li neder, I'll come back to this. I just wanted you to see that he brings this up within our context. He says the salt is a covenant. It's called Brit Melech. The salt is a covenant. And having the salt on the table protects you when no one's doing any mitzvot. You're just sitting around. Okay, so basically, our whole search for findings, because I said right away, you know, what's the law here? Is it a Torah law, rabbinic law, custom, whatever, superstition? And somebody quoted to me the idea that, who quoted this? That a table is like a mizbeach. Some of you said it right away, right? You're all going to deny it now? I heard.
I was quoting one of my teachers.
I heard some of you say, because a table is like a mizbeach. So now we just now, and you, again, you could, I can challenge you to go back to your teachers, go back to your Gana note, go back to whoever said this to you and say, okay, table is like a mizbeach, but who said you can't sit on a table? We've seen all kinds of other things. You should have achnasat archim. You should feed aniyim. You should say divrei Torah. You should take the knife off the table. You should put salt on the table. We've seen all kinds of things. There's just one thing we haven't seen yet. And what's that? I accept that it's so obvious. I would just love if somebody, either alive or dead, actually wrote it. Spoken like a mother. Anyway. That's a good question. Let's look. So by the way, after searching through every single comment in rabbinic literature that quoted this verse about a table being like a mizbeach, I can assure you that I went through every single thing that I can find. Everybody quoting it, every single context, and the one thing I didn't find was you could sit on the table. So then I said, you know what? let me call up this guy who wrote this book, Shmirat HaGuf HaNefesh. And he said, yeah, it's in my book, Shmirat HaGuf. I called him up, and he said, yeah, it's in my book. And he directed me, told me exactly what page, which I felt pretty stupid because I had the book. I just could have opened it myself. But I just figured that if I couldn't find it, so then whatever. I called him. And let's look at source 17 and 18 because this is as good as he was willing, as he was able to do. And we'll see what we have here. Source 18 is the Sefer Chassidim. What is the Sefer Chassidim? Sefer Chassidim is a book by Rav Yehuda HaChassid. Rav Yehuda HaChassid lived hundreds of years before the Baal Shem Tov and never heard of Chassidim. This is called Chassidei Ashkenaz, 12th or 13th century. A great deal of Kabbalistic things in this book. Many, if not most, of the superstitions that you're aware of in Judaism come from the Sefer Chassidim. A lot of it is based upon a will that he wrote to his descendants, and there's a big question whether anything that he wrote is valid or relevant to anybody other than his descendants. Listen to what he writes, how he writes it, what it says, and more importantly, what it doesn't say. Yelid achad amad lefsoa ala shulchan shaviv haya masim tadir sfarav alav. A kid climbed on a table that his father used to put his books on. So what kind of table is this? This is a book that was a table that was used for learning, a desk. Lo yichudo rak lesfarim levad. The father never established it or designated it, that's a better word, never designated this exclusively for his Torah learning books. V'gam kishiratza lechol alav lechem. And also, if he wanted to, he would also eat sometimes on the table. Uvachol yom sfarim alav, and every day he had books on it. V'lakachas v'rimei alav ad she'achal. But if he would eat, he would take the books off, and then he would eat on the table. V'amad hayelet al ha'shulchan. The kid climbed on the table, stood on the table. V'yarad, and then he climbed down. V'nechtach kaf riglo b'sakin. And he ended up cutting his foot on the knife that was on the table. Amar ha'av, the father then said, Pish'i gar'am, my sins have caused my son to get cut. Shehednachti levni lepsoa al shulchan, shiur lev sfarim. For I let my son climb on the table that I use for books. Now, he could have had a different conclusion. He could have said, go ahead, say it. He could have said, I let my kid climb on a table with a knife on it, and that's why he got cut. But that's not what he said, and that's not what the Sefer Chassidim writes. What he writes is that the father has this spiritual, you know, awakening, and he says, I let my kid climb on a table that was used for spiritual things, used with my books, and that was obviously inappropriate. This book, this table should have holiness to it, and therefore he never should have let him. Now, to say this would be then the source, that you can't sit on a table, you all realize is a little pushing it, because it actually doesn't say that. What does it say? It says you shouldn't climb on a table, which is used for Divrei Ketushah. For example, if I would say this, say you have a bima in a Beit Knesset, which they use to read the Torah on, do you think it would be appropriate for kids to be climbing on that table and playing on that table? You'd say, no, that's a table which is used for Sefer Torah. So therefore, you could say on some level, it could be that books are somehow like a Sefer Torah, on maybe somewhat of a lower level, and should not be used for frivolous things. But over here, the table and the Mizbeach and the analogy, this has nothing to do with the Gemara that we saw. Good? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Look in source 18 now. And this, I have to admit, I would not have found without his book. The other one I could have found, but this I would not have found. It's a book called Yosef. It looks like it says Yosef, but that's a mistake if you see the English underneath it. It's Yosef Ometz, which is a book of customs. As you see, the author lives in 1570, 1637. And he writes as follows: Asur lishev o lahamid hatinok al hashtender. Do you all know what a shtender is? A shtender is a thing that people generally learn to keep their books when they're either learning or davening. You shouldn't let the kids sit on a shtender. Shamasimin alav machzorim v'tfilot. Shamiyuchad lekodesh. It's something which is designated for a holy activity. You should not let a kid sit on such a thing. V'katav Rav Elazar mimitz, otanav hasaf salim, shumashim alav na'arim mebeit ha'knesset, she'ein ba'alim rishain lechzor licham lebatei and leshev alav. That if you have chairs or benches which are designated for a shul, where people sit and use it in a shul, you should not then take it out to use it in your home. Even if you exchange it for better chairs or better benches, this was designated for something holy. Okay, I'm not going to get into this law right now, if this is law, a custom, or something else, but that is interesting. And he continues and he says, and he shouldn't use something which is designated for something holy, for something less. And whoever is careful about this will get a bracha. And so it's very interesting. He doesn't seem to be saying it as a law, because if it was a law, he'd say you can't do it. And he says, v'hamachmir. If you're machmir on this, which means if you're stringent, you get a bracha. V'yafilu al shulchan she'ochlim alav katav b'sefer chasidim she'asur. And even a table that's used for eating, the sefer chasidim said, you're not allowed to use it then for something which is not holy. This, by the way, is as close as we're going to get to a source that says that you can't sit on a table. And there's one problem with the source. What's the problem? He's quoting the Sefer Chasidim, and it's not what the Sefer Chasidim said. Right. So over here, his conclusion that therefore you can't sit on a table because the table is designated for holiness. Again, it's interesting. He doesn't bring the thing about the Mizbeach. He doesn't quote it. And he quotes the Sefer Chasidim because it's designated for something which is holy. That's very nice, but that's actually not what the Sefer Chasidim said, which therefore leads us for our conclusion. As far as I can tell, there is absolutely no source whatsoever for the custom not to sit on a table. That's as far as I could tell. I discussed this with a couple of people, including Rav Shabtai Rappaport, who's married to Moshe Feinstein's granddaughter, and he said to me, there's absolutely no such law. He says, there's no law like this. And when I discussed with him the sukkah question, he said, oh, the minhag in Yerushalayim all the time was they had small sukkot, lots of kids, and of course the kids slept on the table. He goes, that was minhag in Yerushalayim. When I mentioned this, without quoting the name, to Rabbi Lerner, he said, what are you talking about? Nobody in Yerushalayim ever did such a thing, and he couldn't, this is, meaning, he's obviously wrote a book on Shmirat HaGuf HaNefesh, and he's convinced that this is something which is very dangerous spiritually. How do you see it's dangerous spiritually? Because the Sefer Chasidim considers it dangerous spiritually. So I want to be careful now. The Sefer Chasidim is not a binding halacha book, but it's better than that. It's a book full of bad omens and things which are dangerous spiritually. Somebody long ago said that it's a shame the Sefer Chasidim never wrote. I mean, he wrote things like you can't marry somebody with the same name as your husband, or same name that you certainly can't do. The same name as your father, or a man can't have the same name as his mother, and things like that. Right. You can't, meaning there are all kinds of names. That's from the Sefer Chasidim. No point in Jewish law says such a thing. And basically, the Sefer Chasidim is not necessarily a binding book. But I said somebody said it's a shame the Sefer Chasidim never wrote that it's spiritually damaging if you steal. I mean. Or cheat, or commit adultery, that this could be damaging. That he only said things like, you know, don't sit on the table. Because people are very worried about things which are spiritually damaging. I mean, not so worried with what God said, but very, very worried about things in the Sefer Chasidim. So first of all, is this book something which is binding? So not necessarily binding. All of you are brought up, if you can't sit on a table, so far be it from me to come and say that you go ahead and sit on the table. On the other hand, if you ask me, is there any validity to this? Is it a Torah law? Because it's like the Mizbeach, apparently it's not, because no one ever made that statement as far as I could tell. Somebody find some other source, then please correct me. Is it a rabbinic law? Isn't it a rabbinic law? Is it a custom? If it is a custom, and we have found what it's based on, it seems to be very questionable. Now, as far as the question of sleeping in the sukkah on the table, I haven't answered that yet, because there may be other considerations, including what exactly is the status of a table on Shabbos or Yom Tov, in terms of the whole thing of the tablecloth and so on, and that we need to still consider, and that we will come back to on a future date. Have a good Shabbos. It's all kinds of things which are there. It's two volumes, all kinds of things, including garlic and onion is in the book. Don't worry, it's all there.